Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 5 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're heading up to the skies to talk astronomy with Crystal De Napoli. Crystal is a Gomeroi educator and astrophysicist dedicated to the advocacy of Indigenous knowledges and equity in STEM. She is the host of Indigenuity on 3RRR, a weekly radio show that showcases Indigenous knowledge holders, and she's also a graduate researcher at Monash University. Crystal is the recipient of numerous honours, including Out for Australia's 30 Under 30 Awards and Young Professional of the Year. Her debut book, Astronomy, Sky Country, co-authored with Carly Noon, was published by Thames and Hudson in 2022. Astronomy, Sky Country is the fourth title in the extraordinary First Knowledges series, edited by Margot Neal, a series of six books that provide a deeper understanding of the expertise and ingenuity of Indigenous Australians. Regular listeners of Archive Fever might remember that back in Season 3, we interviewed Margot Neal and her co-author Lynn Kelly about the first book in the series, Songlines, The Power and the Promise. That episode, entitled You Wouldn't Blow Up the National Library, is well worth a listen if you haven't heard it already. In Astronomy, Sky Country, Crystal and Carly show us how First Nations people on this continent were the world's first astronomers. The book won the People's Choice Award at the 2023 Victorian Premier's Literary Awards and was also shortlisted for the award for Indigenous writing. The judges described Astronomy, Sky Country as an incredibly well-researched and critical text that explores the idea of the sky as an archive for our knowledge systems. Crystal, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Crystal, let's go back to the beginning where your passion for astronomy all began. You've spoken about how you started noticing the stars when you were a child outside at night with your family. And in a really beautiful recent Queer Stories story, you described how your mum taught you and your sister about the Seven Sisters constellation and the story behind that. Was that when you first developed a passion for astronomy, do you think?
Yeah, very specifically. It's sort of funny in hindsight, reflecting on where my interest in the skies emerged from. And I think it's weirdly specific that I can narrow it down to like this one evening on Pangerang Country. But it really was life-changing. I feel like, you sort of see the stars but don't really absorb them. And that was my first time sort of being quite bored at a family gathering and then, you know, taking to be outside in the evening with me and my sister, lying on a trampoline, and my mum coming to join us. And, you know, what do? You sort of just lie there and stare upwards. And so for me, it just looked very pretty. We're in a very dark area and being able to see so many stars. But it was when mum started trying to actually point things out to me that I realised that there was actually a bit more sort of structure to the skies. And then I really struggled to see it. Absolutely failed in a way that my sister was succeeding in trying to note all these objects that she was talking about. Apparently there were a lot of shooting stars that I was missing. And especially as a young kid, because I would have been, I don't even know how old, definitely between like the ages of like, say, 5 and 8. For me, it was really frustrating to not be able to see what they're talking about. You know, apparently there's people in the sky. And so for me, I just felt really determined to try and spot them in future. It's almost like very stubborn rebellion.
So you became an astronomer out of competition with your sister.
Yeah, out of spite. But yeah, it was just absolutely beautiful. And then the more I just grew up, because there wasn't a whole lot to do, especially on my side of town. So like we didn't have a car. We lived very far away from like the centre of town, Wangaratta in the northeast. So beautiful, very beautiful place. For me, very mixed experience because of the conditions in which my family lived in. So when there's not a whole lot to do and a lot to entertain yourself with, I'd find myself out, you know, walking around the streets and stuff a lot, particularly at night as well, you know, just looking upwards constantly and just being so enamored with the stars. And yeah, it really led to everything I feel for today.
And was there something particular about the Seven Sisters story that caught you? Because I know you're one of seven siblings, so there must have been some kind of resonance there, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm one of seven siblings. I'm the second oldest, and I was sort of parentified pretty young. So I'm very protective of my siblings, love them so much. And my mum's very similar. She's one of five. She's the youngest. And she has, you know, four sisters, and I had four sisters as well. So there was those themes, I guess, to connect with pretty instantly about, I guess, like the camaraderie between those stars, the way that they're quite often described, and that sort of theme as well of, you know, there being seven sisters, it really sprung to me. But they're also quite hard to see. You try and find them when you're looking for like the constellation of Orion, and you can sort of trace along trying to spot where the seven sisters are. And that's something that's usually a bit easier for people to see, like Orion's belt, very bright stars, Betelgeuse is in it. That's a very bright star that's very interesting. But the seven sisters are very faint and very delicate. And so trying to find them has always been a massive challenge. And it's actually only been since starting my studies where I can now spot them in the night sky with absolute ease, which is very exciting, but also very bittersweet because for that context, unfortunately, my mum passed away during my first semester. So even though she inspired that sort of look towards the skies and everything that's come from it, she has no idea, or she never got to have any idea of what I'd actually go on to do. And especially since like no one in our family has gone to university or even really finished high school. Like my mum never did. My dad sort of did in a way. I don't think she probably would have been able to foresee what would have occurred. And it's a shame in that way because I feel, you know, it all began with her. It'd be really cool for her to see where it's taken me.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. It's beautiful, but yeah, really sad. When you are, you know, looking up at the night sky, do you sort of get a sense of feeling transfixed by what you're seeing? You know, on this podcast, we often talk about archive fever as the feeling of being consumed by the research process and you lose all sense of kind of time and so on. Do you kind of get something like that when you're looking up at the sky?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What does it feel like for you?
Especially with, I guess, like the more I learn about just the universe in general, this all started with looking up to the skies, seeing beautiful stars. And especially when you're like lying down and looking up to them, you feel like you can really just ascend and disappear, almost like falling upwards, right? And then the more I've like learned about just how massive the universe is, it is absolutely insane. Some context, this is my absolute favorite like analogy, if that's the right word for it. If you were to go to every single beach in the world, and there's many of them, especially around Australia, and you were to collect every single grain of sand off of all of those beaches, that is the same number of stars that there are in our Milky Way.
Wow.
And that's just our galaxy. There are as many galaxies out there as there are stars in our galaxy. On that sort of timeline, like we have a very small sun and we're an even smaller planet. And so it's just surreal to me now when I look up because it's not just sort of this dome that stops there, but you can really just find yourself being lost and poured into something that is so vast beyond what our brains can sort of comprehend. So yeah, to me, it's just surreal.
Crystal, I love that expression you just used, falling upwards.
Yeah.
Generally, we associate the idea of falling as a negative, failing or falling as in tipping off a precipice into an abyss. But you describe that in such a positive way. You know, it might be a kind of archive fever, it might be obsessive, but it's also transcendent. Can you just tap into that feeling a little bit more for us?
I feel like for me, what sort of emerges a lot is I get like a lot of weightlessness when I look up to the skies. And I'm sure this is similar for most people, so I'm not trying to make it sound, you know, I feel like I've had particularly heavy themes in my life and I feel quite weighed down by life pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. Even now, it's such a shame that I feel like sometimes I get too much caught up in the negatives that I feel I'm surrounded by at times instead of being able to embrace the amazing things that have occurred, especially over the last few years. And so there's something about lying under stars, very dark skies and looking upwards where all of that really becomes insignificant. And so for me, I get super lost in that feeling. And it's just so beautiful because for me, probably sounds conflicting, but that idea of like sort of falling upwards and like getting lost in the stars above is also super grounding. It reminds me of what's actually important and what's super relevant. And especially when you're a speck in the universe and you're sort of like lost in these stars upwards and thinking about everything that's led to me having these connections to stars and everything, it helps me forget things that are quite stressful and heavy because the focus is just the beauty in the universe and the love I have for my family and the things that I'm focused on and studying. I guess like the archive fever equivalent for the stars, I absolutely feel in abundance.
I love that. I have this vision of you now, like lying on your back, looking at the stars and kind of gently floating upwards.
Yeah.
Let's now turn to the book, Astronomy Sky Country, which has been so wonderfully successful. How did you come to write this book with Carly?
This might be like the opposite approach from what people experience. I think I've been very lucky with my experience with writing books in the way that we were approached by the publisher. So This series, First Knowledges series, is absolutely fantastic. I'm like a massive fan of the series and all the other authors involved. To be a part of it, I've had to get over a lot of imposter syndrome, I feel. I can sort of communicate in this space with a confident voice, especially because as an astrophysics graduate, I've always been super connected to the skies. I'm very passionate about my culture. And for me, when going to university and meeting just an incredible abundance of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students and all the amazing things they were doing, everyone I spoke to always had a way in which their studies were linking back to their communities and making a positive impact. I was so obsessed with the skies, and I was so focused on, for example, like student engagement, student retention and everything at university for Indigenous students. I felt sort of guilty in realizing that my studies seemed quite disconnected from my culture. Essentially, community support for me to get there and then for me to not, I guess, work and sort of bring anything back. And I've come to learn that that's a pretty common feeling of guilt and desire to contribute positively to your community that a lot of Indigenous students feel. And so for me, as soon as I was aware of Indigenous astronomy, and I actually became aware of it, like the science through Carly Noon's work, which is like a really funny roundabout way how this has all happened, because when I was in university, she was my idol because she was the first person I'd ever heard about talking about Aboriginal astronomy. And she had made history as the first Aboriginal woman to graduate with a degree in physics and maths, which was historic. We haven't had a lot of representation in this field, and we haven't had a lot of public discussion of our deadly knowledge systems and the very long history of science here. And so for me, as soon as I became aware of Carly's work, I just wanted to learn everything I could. And then when meeting the research group and getting to get involved, I became so passionate and dedicated to speaking about this publicly and at schools and libraries and just trying to make people aware. And, you know, the more talks I did, the more interested people were. So for me, I've just been very focused, I guess, on the communication side of this topic. And so with this amazing series they're putting together, they wanted every single book to focus on a different area of Aboriginal knowledge. And so for the astronomy portion, they turned to me and Carly. So I think very lucky, I guess, in that way to be approached by a publisher, but I guess we had presented ourselves as voices in the field who could speak to this area when there isn't a whole lot of voices. So we got that opportunity. So that was great. Carly and I had known each other for a couple of years at that point. Very early on, we're trying to think of like the structure and what we wanted to communicate through it. For me, it's like it's not just an introduction to how deadly our knowledge systems are and how cool this astronomy is and how it's the world's first and we have some of the oldest observatories here, but they look a different format from what people are sort of used to in a Western framework. But also it was an opportunity to talk about some issues that I feel very passionately about. And a lot of that are the stresses facing sky country, like light pollution being actually a very harmful ecological process. It was good. When we got together, we had a very clear, pretty united idea of the things that we wanted to discuss. And then got stuck into it for a year or so.
Fantastic. As I noted in introducing you, Astronomy Sky Country examines the idea of sky as a kind of archive for Indigenous knowledges. And you have a sentence in the book where you describe this really beautifully. You write that, quote, "The skies can be thought of as being equivalent to a library for oral cultures, where each star is a book that can be called upon to unlock the traditions and knowledges associated with us." Can you unpack this idea for us a little bit? How do Indigenous peoples read the sky like a library?
I guess for some sort of like starting context for people just to be comfortable with this idea of cultures around the world look to the skies, and quite often we look at groups of stars and we sort of lump them together and assign a meaning and usually a story with that. And so we're sort of familiar with that idea already of, I guess, assigning information to a structure we see in the sky. And so when it comes to Aboriginal knowledge systems, they are just so intrinsically interconnected. So when it comes to me talking about sky knowledge, usually the skies are informing us about things that are happening on the land that we need to be aware of. And so this can come in the form of being able to track animal cycles and plant cycles, and also to be able to navigate across country, to be able to predict weather or forecast seasonality. This is all completely interconnected. Usually when we're focusing on the stars, for example, it can be any specific star, or it can be the constellations where we're grouping stars together, or it can also be dark regions of the sky, which are very notable to Indigenous astronomers. And those informations, because of our interconnected knowledge system, those stars will usually tell you about changes in the environment. So, for example, the Seven Sisters, the Pleiades, gorgeous, beautiful stars. I did a lot of research on them in my time in university. And so, for example, if we just look to where the Seven Sisters are throughout the year, they help us forecast seasonal change. Many cultures, so for Gomori community, we use them to understand that the frost is coming. We see them as beings of ice, and there's some really cool stories sort of behind it. But we refer to them as Murray Murray, and so that's referring to this group of young women. We associate them with the frost because when it's the time of year where things get all icy on the ground. It's actually the last time that they sort of dip below the horizon at night, and then they sort of disappear for a few months. So it's like when they touch the ground, they finally bring all the frost with them. And yet at the same time, that one group of stars also forecast hot weather or hot seasons for groups in the central desert because they're blaring overhead during summer, which is nice and hot, and so they're associated with the heat. And then at the same time, they help forecast plant cycles and harvest cycles. So this is just like one group of stars that links into so many areas of the environment. So for us, everything's super interconnected, and you can usually trace it back to a star or to trace it back to a cluster of stars. And so for us, that is our book, that is our encyclopedia. Each star contains not just one bit of knowledge, not telling you just one thing for a certain community, but can tell you so many. Many of our elders, and still to this day, can name individual stars, like thousands of stars, and be able to tell you exactly what they are and where they are. And so when you have all of this and it's so connected with everything else in your environment, it really does become your library. Each of those stars are your books that you can access. And so that's why things like light pollution become very relevant, because as we start to lose access to our skies, we are losing access to that library.
So, Crystal, if the night sky is an archive or a librarian, who gets to be the archivist or the librarian in this situation? Do selected people gain the ability to read the night sky? Do elders have more knowledge that they have to pass on? Is it that knowledge is acquired over a lifetime? Or is it available to all Indigenous people right from the get-go?
So it's very varied, probably would be very specific to communities as well. For example, a lot of young fellas are super, super crazy knowledgeable with the sky. And that's information that they've been taught as they're growing up probably through their family that is just relevant for them to know, because the stars can help us know when to fish or when to harvest certain plants or to be able to predict wet weather. For others, though, they're usually very specific roles within the community. So elders hold the most knowledge. And for some communities, they specifically have like star lore people. So certain information is transmitted through ceremony. I guess as like an example, the one thing that is really cool about Indigenous science is that a lot of our science and our observations are recorded in oral traditions, so in stories usually. And so I tend to give the example of, if I want to tell you about two objects in the sky, I can do so by actually telling you a story about two characters that represent those objects. And I can represent the way they move across the sky by talking about the relationship and the interactions between those two characters. And so when information is in that format, in this sort of story, you can make it as simplistic or as complicated as you want to. And there are said to be just so many different layers to oral traditions. And so we tend to talk about things that are quite public sort of knowledge, but more knowledgeable people and elders would have complete access to more depth of layers between those oral traditions. And also then we also have certain divides as well, so some sort of sacred knowledge that is more for sort of women and sister girls in the community versus knowledge that is intended for male. And so there's that also that separation. So there's just very different careful ways of, I guess, handling certain knowledge and the way that it's transmitted. But a lot of our young people are just crazy knowledgeable about everything to do with your environment. It always absolutely blows my mind. For example, like the Torres Strait, and also had a group tour from Arnhem Land, and I'm talking to them about astronomy, and they know way more than even I do. And that's just practical knowledge that's so, I guess, necessary for them in their environment to be aware of. It's essentially varied, but it is amazing, I feel, just how much, I guess, like information our brains are used to storing, especially over the very long timescales that we've persisted on.
Speaking of very long timescales, you've described Australia's First Nations people as the world's first astronomers. So it sounds like from what you're saying, it's not just that First Nations people here knew the same stuff about the stars and the solar system that European astronomers later claimed to discover, but they actually held a whole set of different knowledges about the night sky that were in a sense lost to the Enlightenment.
Yeah, so we have like a very long history of astronomy. So we have a number of stories which are exploring events that have happened thousands of years ago and are still held within those traditions, which are fantastic. And then we have also observations of objects thousands of years ago that have been relatively only sort of agreed upon in the last few hundred years from Western astronomy. And then we also have a unique way of looking at the sky that doesn't exist in the Northern Hemisphere. One of the ways that sort of, I guess, like manifests a lot is that we have this beautiful view of the Milky Way that doesn't really exist as much in the Northern Hemisphere. And a lot of that has set the tone for the ways that we view the skies. And so that's also where that focus on the dark spaces comes from. Because we appreciate not just the beauty in the light, but also those spaces in between. And that's something that also seems to be specific to not just Aboriginal cultures, but Southern Hemispherian cultures. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be because we get this beautiful, unique view of the Milky Way, which has these gas and dust that blocks that light. So yeah, there's a mix of things that we've known about for a long time before, and then there are other ways of just uniquely looking at the skies as well.
How do you feel about Western astronomers and the way that their knowledges are taught in the sort of basic astrophysics course that you must have undertaken?
Every time I hear like Astronomy 101 and like the history of astronomy, it's always the same progression of like white Eurocentric astronomers. It gets very old, especially like when you're sort of, this is the information that's presented, because it's not just me being like, oh, I know about Aboriginal astronomy and the depth of it and how old it is. And to me, to hear about someone from like the 1600s versus like us having tens of thousands of years is a little stuffy. But there are also so many other cultures who have contributed fantastically to astronomy in, say, like the last 4,000 years, Arabic astronomers and that, who have just set the tone early on, that also don't really get talked about in those classrooms. And so I feel like it's just presented in a very sort of specific way. It's a shame because like I don't resent those Eurocentric astronomers. Actually, like some of my favorite space focused people from the 1600s happen to be Italian, and that's another part of my heritage, and I find that very cool. But I do get sort of tired, I think, of only ever hearing those narratives, because it's not just overlooking ours, but it's overlooking actually many perspectives around the world that contributed to astronomy long before the same discoveries essentially were made more recently.
What a shock. White people from Europe claimed all the knowledge for themselves.
Never heard of that happening before. Crystal, I want to go back to light pollution, which you've mentioned a few times already. Reading your book, it made me realise that light pollution is kind of threatening the archive of the sky in the same way that we might say government underfunding is threatening the National Archives of Australia. And, you know, we've recently had in the last few years a lot of media campaign and attention to get funding for the National Archives. The general public can kind of understand that as a threat, but I think it might be less familiar to think about the sky as a cultural institution that's been threatened by light. But as you make clear, like, it's just as potentially devastating, if not more so. Can you explain to us what light pollution is and how it threatens this library in the sky?
Light pollution, it's got a beautiful correlation with population size and density. Mm. So it's weird for me being in Melbourne. It is so normal to only see like 100 or so stars in the sky. And I speak to so many students from this area about their access to the skies and things that they've observed. And so many of them have like never seen the Milky Way, seemingly never really stepped out into a dark sky before, which is surreal to me because where I've come from, I'm very used to like dark skies. And so it's still weird going out and having this sort of artificial glow. Mm. So light pollution comes in many formats and it's so unnecessary. It's essentially things like over-illuminating, for example, business buildings after hours that just have absolutely zero purpose. Even just street lights that have no correct fitting. And so all that light spilling everywhere. Like you may want to intend to illuminate a road or a pathway, and instead all of this is just spilling upwards. And so it all culminates together in this effect called sky glow, which is where all that light's going upwards, things are looking way brighter, you're seeing 100 star instead of a couple of thousand, and 80% of the world's population now lives under sky glow, which means 80% of the world's population has no access to the Milky Way, but also just in general an abundance of stars. The reason it's so concerning, there's a human health element that I don't tend to talk about too much because, you know, that's already super depressing, but it's fascinating how unaware, I guess, we are of the artificial light in our environment and the impact on our bodies. But when it comes to, for us, for the skies and the way that we use the skies as our library, as our archive, what's happening is a couple of things. One, it is covering our access to the stars. And so I said sort of before about how, you know, once we start losing access to those books, these are reference points for not just like one fact in our community, but sometimes one star meaning several things. And then that thing will tie into many other areas. It is just this interconnected web of knowledge. And so as we start to lighten the skies, we lose access to those stars. And so for us, that's, you know, just not having easy access to be able to understand the changes in our environment that we would usually be aware of. But then there's like another sort of side effect as well to our knowledge system in general. So it's still impacting the overall archive. And that's light pollution in our environment is having a really harmful effect on a lot of native species. So unfortunately, quite a few, it's leading to them becoming increasingly endangered, very severely. Like we have critically endangered species and it's all tied to light pollution. What's happening is like a lot of our native species are either birthing their young into a time of year where there's no food for them available because light in your environment tricks your body into thinking it's a different season, or just physically causing harm. So sending certain migratory species off path, or sending birds into buildings, for our urban birds as well, who can't sleep with any light in their environment. And so we have a lot of species that are just not sleeping. They can't recover it during the daylight. And then we have a lot of bigger animals who rely on those certain migratory species, like the bogon moth and the mountain pygmy possum relies on the bogon moth, a migratory species, to arrive in its population area to be able to eat it. And since that's a hibernating species, the pygmy possum, it needs to be able to double its mass after hibernation through eating that moth. And because of light pollution, what's happening is that moth's not arriving and they've had a dramatic decrease in their population size. I think it was in 2018, the bogon moth went from several billion down to a couple hundred in the area. It was such a dramatic decrease in a food source for the mountain pygmy possum. And mountain pygmy possum is now critically endangered. And they've gotten to the point where they tried to have a campaign to get people to turn off their lights. It didn't work. And so now they're at the point where there are a couple of things they're considering, which is forcing a change in the mountain pygmy possum's natural behavior, force it into a warmer climate so it doesn't go into hibernation. So there are a whole bunch of things that are so unnecessary when you could just turn off the lights. And because of that, because a lot of our species are either getting confused about what time of year they're in or are having like a significant reduction to their population sizes, that also impacts our knowledge system. So the stars in the sky, which inform us about that animal behavior, are becoming out of sync and irrelevant. And so it's like the whole system overall is affected. It's our access to seeing the stars, but it's also what light pollution does to the health of our environment and the way that it impacts those other, I guess, tendrils or other links to our knowledge system that is also having a really harmful impact. And I feel the more I've learned about the ecological impact, that I've just become aware of how dangerous light pollution is. So I try and talk about it more because most people have no idea.
Crystal, how much is your work as a scientist and a researcher intrinsically linked to being an activist and a reformer, someone who's committed to shifting deep-seated epistemological cultural narratives that Indigenous astronomy is a kind of antidote to the long colonial tale of terra nullius, that this land was inhabited by nomads who lived without agricultural or pastoral or scientific practices? But as well as shifting epistemological narratives, it also sounds like you are an activist in the environmental space as well. Are these two things indivisible for you now?
Yeah. It's funny, I've never been asked that question before, but absolutely. I guess activism is so intrinsic to everything I've done, and actually I guess it's probably motivated the steps I've taken from the get-go. I guess as like an Aboriginal person who is trying to, I guess, break, I don't know how to describe it properly, but I guess like break down certain structures that I find particularly offensive and long overdue, it's sort of inevitable that I need to be, I guess, on that front line, I guess. So it's like even if I didn't want my work to be grounded in activism or political, it's sort of unavoidable. To some people, just me even saying that Aboriginal people have a form of science is seen as super controversial. Regardless of what I do, even if I think I try and it's going to fall into that area of activism, essentially, because I'm pushing for change in different areas.
Yeah, so claiming the sky is part of claiming sovereignty.
Absolutely, entirely, especially with the fact that like for many Aboriginal communities, we have a viewpoint of like the land and the skies being so intrinsically interconnected, and at the point of creation being one that was sort of torn in two. The skies are a reflection of the ground. And so for us, when sky country is also hurting, we are. It impacts, as I said, cultural heritage with our access to the skies, our knowledge systems, the impact of changing our knowledge systems as well and making them sort of out of sync. So protecting sky country is really just in tune with also, I guess, asserting our sovereignty and trying to heal country overall.
And it makes me think about the acknowledgement of country that we do it now at almost all public gatherings and many private ones as well, and acknowledge traditional owners past and present. I've always assumed that what I was doing was acknowledging the people who were the traditional owners of the land on which we work and live, which is often a phrase that we use. But now I'm thinking, and I've never thought this before this interview, now I need to think about that. Like that's a whole conceptual change to think you're actually acknowledging sky country as well.
Absolutely. And even just that term country, because I think it's equivalent or it's synonymous, it's spelt the same way as the word country in English language. People think of it very literally as like, yes, of course, it's like the literal land that I'm on top of. Country for us is everything. So not just the land and the waterways, but also the skies, but also the people, the animals, everything contained within that. We're all connected and we're all part of this system. I try and make a point of acknowledging very explicitly sky country and waterways and the land that we're on when giving acknowledgements, because it is that whole system. And I've realized some people aren't aware of what we're trying to explain when we're talking about welcoming you to country or in acknowledging the country that you're on, because it's acknowledging everything, the people, the animals, the whole system as a whole.
So if we were to fully acknowledge Indigenous sovereignty over Sky Country, what would that look like? Like, what would change in the practices of, you know, how space is used or not used?
So that's a great question. I've been thinking a lot about sky sovereignty and everything a lot, and we've recently written a chapter which is about safeguarding Indigenous sky rights, because a lot of things are happening up in space. Astronomy's not done great things to Indigenous people, and that's like another weird thing about being in the field, because we have very clear examples of, you know, scientists going, hey, this is a beautiful clear spot to put an observatory. Let's just do that without consultation. And so in particular, places like Hawaii and stuff, unfortunately, astronomers have made a terrible impact on those people. For example, we have a lot of excitement around those low Earth orbit satellites and the mega constellations. Thanks, Elon Musk. But essentially like Starlink, where we have all these bright satellites. And if you've seen them out in the sky when they're above, they are so bright. Like, they stand out beyond the stars. They are unmissable. Last year, I think we had a couple of thousand. That was just like Starlink. And at the same time, we had five companies putting in requests for 400,000. That is insane. Like, we only had 4,500 total satellites in the skies last year. And at the same time, we had around 30,000 bits of space debris. Trying to introduce 400,000 more of these super bright satellites, and that's just five companies. There are so many more right around the world as people want to get in on this technology. And so we're doing this, I guess, like this dramatic changing of the skies, because those are contributing to light pollution. They are also ruining astronomers' observations, but that's not too relevant in this discussion. But also, at the same time, they're risking something called a Kessler syndrome. Essentially, there's this theory of, hey, with one satellite or one bit of space debris, and there was already 30,000 for just 4,000, so imagine how much with 400,000 plus. If just one of those bits of space debris or a satellite hits another, inevitably it's going to cause more space debris and also veer off course, which essentially just risks all of that debris hitting other satellites and other bits of space debris, and it just keeps going until we essentially end up with a super heavily polluted orbit around Earth. That's not easy to clean up. I feel like a lot of these things aren't properly tracked. We had a super controversial thing that happened in Australia, I think just last year or the year before, where one of the Starlink satellites actually crashed down onto a New South Wales farm, and it was huge. One of our astronomers was like standing next to it, and it's like way taller than him, lodged so firmly into the ground that would have killed. Like, that would have absolutely destroyed a house, for example. Very lucky it ended up on farmland. So for me, there's like a lot of concerns about permanent impact. When it comes to sort of this discussions of Indigenous sky rights and sky sovereignty, I think the one thing that's really important is for scientists to acknowledge that cultures around the world have a connection to the skies that should be valued. And they've had that for many cultures for a very, very, very long time. And in science, we have this misunderstanding, however you want to phrase it, incorrect narrative that science is this beautiful, objective, factual way of looking at the world or the universe, and that those decisions are made through this objective lens without cultural bias, which is obviously a load of crap because science has emerged from a specific, like, it's from a culture. It has those biases regardless, one of those being disregarding seemingly other cultures' connections to the skies. And so when it comes to sky sovereignty, we are sort of trying to raise the idea of Indigenous sky rights. We gave a comparison at the end of the book because people were comfortable with acknowledging, okay, wasn't terra nullius, all right, we'll acknowledge Indigenous people have a connection to the land. In some areas, you know, people get more sort of rights over their land, but not a whole lot. For example, like the Mabo judgment was a very important one in that regard. But then there was also a follow-up regarding the Torres Strait Islander connection, because it wasn't just for their lands, but it was actually also acknowledging their waterways. Yes, sea rights. And so they had to demonstrate that they actually did communicate and traverse across in between islands. And I'm summarizing this as an astronomer, so for anyone who's more well-versed in this, I apologize. But through what I know through astronomy, they had to prove essentially that there was a connection between the islands and that they did traverse those waters and have a right to them. And one of the ways they actually did that was through Indigenous astronomy. So a beautiful moon song or a moon dance, I think called Gejtagaya, which is essentially in both of the languages of two of the islands. It describes the route home, and it's in the two languages, and it's been performed and everything for a very, very long time. And apparently the judge went out and actually saw that performed in person, and that was used as the evidence to grant water rights in that regard. And so I feel like we've more than demonstrated that the skies are just an essential resource for us. It is an archive for all of our knowledge systems. And so I think it's important for us to discuss ways and try and work towards ways that we can make sure that those skies are reachable for not just Aboriginal people, but also cultures around the world. And so that would be focusing on things like light pollution and trying to reduce it, being very careful about those mega constellations, those low Earth orbit satellites, before it turns into a larger problem. It absolutely would not be the first time that scientists have embraced a technology and not realized they've almost ended the world. The CFCs and the hole in the ozone layer is something that, you know, could have caused massive, massive destruction and was caught, I guess, in the nick of time for that sort of recovery. What I'm witnessing has me greatly concerned. And so when it comes to Indigenous sky rights, because for our perspective and what we're writing about is that we argue you can't think of space as a sphere nullius. You can't think of it as a no man's land because those descriptions that we're working with or the definitions for a terra nullius or a sphere nullius is like a land without law, right? And for us, our skies, completely related to law, they hold our ancestors and our access to our knowledge. And so we feel that it is something that people should prioritize all cultures' access to the skies into making sure that our advancements in science aren't completely ruining that, potentially permanently. Mm. So, yeah, I'm starting to have those sort of probably less popular conversations at the moment. But I do think it's really important to discuss sky sovereignty.
Crystal, I feel like my brain is falling upwards. It's such a mind-expanding conversation that we've had here, and there are so many more avenues that we can take it, but we are going to have to wrap up, unfortunately. But we can't let you go before asking a question that we ask all of our guests here in Archives Anonymous. Do you have any kind of dirty little archive secret that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, maybe this applies. I guess this is quite relevant to when you're writing a book about Aboriginal knowledge as an Aboriginal person and they want everything to be referenced. A lot of the resources that we're dealing with, unfortunately, are quite historic resources that aren't written by our people and are full of inaccuracies and sometimes super, super offensive language. And so for me, actually, one of the hardest part of writing the book was just having to read that crap because that was really difficult to get through. And what was really annoying, especially when it comes to the Seven Sisters, I have such a strong connection to them and such a love for them, and they reveal so much to us. Like, I've hardly even touched in this conversation like what we can tell just from that one cluster of stars. And unfortunately, some of the knowledge about them is written by some of the most offensive authors, you know, people who've done really poorly by community. So knowledge that's sacred publicly and all this just horrific stuff. And I've made a point at this point where I don't want to reference or give those people the time of day. And so for me with the book, probably cheeky, but there were some things where I just refused to reference those particular resources. And I still wanted to include the knowledge because it's our knowledge, but I just didn't want to give those names another time of day and think they should stay rested where where they are. So that's, I think, the cheekiest thing I've sort of done is just sort of say stuff for you to the referencing standard.
they can be silenced in that archive for a while.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Crystal. My mind has also been blown and you're incredible and I can't wait to see what you go on and do next. To learn more about Crystal's work, you can buy her book, Astronomy Sky Country, published by Thames and Hudson, or follow her on Instagram at Crystal DiNapoli or on Twitter, also at Crystal DiNapoli. And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And it does occur to me that this episode has a lot of resonance with the interview that we did with Dr. Alice Gorman, Dr. Space Junk, in season 2 of Archive Fever.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land and sky.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
And so I was due to go off and drift net fish, and there I had this great subject to look at. Quite quickly, within a month or two, I had the most important information about her, including holding the bullets from her gun that were in the evidence box at State Archives out at St. Mary's.